This is episode 146 of How to Human. And in this episode, I want to talk about how we look at the racial disparities in the death rate from COVID-19. I'm going to start with a story about group dynamics. I'm watching The Wire for the first time. I'm on season 1, episode 3. And there were two instances that made me think about group dynamics. One, there was one cop who hit a kid and blinded him in one eye, and which was police brutality, as we saw it. But the cops stood together as a group and said, we are not going to acknowledge brutality, and instead say that it was justified use of force. So they stood together as a group, despite race, despite gender. We're a group of cops. Second, there was, during an arrest, a suspect hit a cop, and then several other cops started beating up the suspect. And one black female cop who saw the incident starts running towards the suspect. We're not sure why. I sort of thought that she was there to stop the beating because it was inappropriate, because it was disproportionate use of force. Or so what one would think. But no, she was going to join in on the beating. So, and the suspect was also black. So it was, again, cops versus everybody. And that's what we often find, is that groups stick together. In a way, that's natural. It's not something we like to talk about. An evolutionary biologist would call it in-group preference. If you're a part of a village and a stranger comes in, you don't know him, you don't trust him. And if other people come wandering in, you don't know them either. You trust the people you know. You trust the people who are like you. This is a natural inclination that kept people alive for millennia. And it's ugly in modern society because we do it by race and gender and nationality and sometimes family membership. But it's still an instinct that we have. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying it exists. So later, I was reading an article by Charles Blow from the New York Times called Social Distancing is a Privilege. And what he was saying was that a disproportionate number of deaths from COVID-19 are poor and black. He said that vulnerable people are hit harder by this virus, and vulnerability intersects with race and poverty, particularly in this country. I've talked about these things before. In episode 48, I talked about the pros and cons of homogeneous and heterogeneous groups. In episode 87, I said, why is America racist? Those are good listens. But what I wanted to discuss today was the tendency to see things from a racial lens, and whether or not it's a good or a bad thing, and how it contributes to the problem. So the easy point made by Charles Blow is that people not in poverty can't empathize with people in poverty. I don't think he's wrong. If we look at the numbers, it's only 20.8% of black people are in poverty, and 10.1% of white people are in poverty. When I say only, it's a giant number. There are roughly 45 million black people in this country. And so that's 9 million. That's a lot. But we are led to believe it is larger, I think. What Charles Blow does make this about race and poverty. He does. There is, in my judgment, an instinct when someone reads an article like this to assume it's about all black people. That this is an article about a country that is so fundamentally racist that all black people bear the entire brunt of it. And that's not what the article says. It's not. But the question is, what do people walk away with? And that's based on the entirety of the messaging that we have in this country right now about how we do race. And this is complicated. I'm making several assumptions. That doesn't mean they're wrong, though. We are experiencing social justice as a world of those with power against those without power. And social justice is roughly every minority standing up and saying, we are not being treated well. We need to be treated better. And here's the problem. They're not wrong. It's not a problem. It's just a fact. Here's the fact. They're not wrong. And the difficulty comes in, how do we fix it, and what are the measurements we use to fix it? Well, let me go a little bit more into the article, because he talks about a couple different things from a couple different metrics. In Milwaukee County, 81% of the deaths from COVID-19 are black people, whereas black people are 26% of the population. In Cook County, Illinois, 58% of the deaths are black people, whereas 23% of the population is black. Only 1 in 6 Latino workers can stay home and work from home during this quarantine period. 1 in 5 black workers can stay home during this quarantine period. 61.5% of people in the top 25% in earnings can work from home. Only 9.2% of people in the bottom 25% can work from home. So taking those statistics together, it is true that where race meets poverty, those people are going to be disproportionately affected. The idea in the article was that these discussions about what people should do, about working home if you can, not going out, these things are a kind of economic elitism, because the people who are saying that aren't required to work for money and food. This, I thought, was a good quote also in the article. In a nation where too many black people have been made to feel that their lives are constantly under threat, the existence of yet another produces less of a panic. I've said that before in a different way. You don't care who you're going to vote for in the next election if you don't know what you're going to eat next week. Or if you're going to eat next week. There is a mental weight that goes on from both aspects, from being in poverty or from being an underclass, that makes life harder and more difficult to navigate. So what is the answer here? How do we solve this? How do we make this right? An interesting idea that I've heard is that the current wave of social justice is different from the civil rights movement of the late 60s. And I'm going to go ahead and start calling it Social Justice 1.0 and Social Justice 2.0. Social Justice 1.0 was equal opportunity. Or in a way that I might say it, was a combination of first and second wave feminism, which I covered in podcasts 138 and 139. Which is generally, give us equality under the law. and then let us be who we are. Let us, with that equality under the law, be as great as we can be, as fail as much as we want, to follow our hearts as we choose. Give us the ability to not be handicapped by the system. Social justice 2.0 is more a combination of third and fourth wave feminism, which does have the postmodernist underpinnings, as does social justice 2.0, which is more the equal outcome philosophy. The idea that disparities we see in outcomes are representative of an unfair system. And here's the difficulty. It is an unfair system. And this isn't Dave Messman saying the world is unfair. This is Dave Messman saying, yes, the system is unfair to people out of power. And it's a hard fix. And I don't know how to fix it. One of the ways that Social Justice 2.0 is trying to fix it is by stating the differences in outcome, pointing to them as evidence of a broken system, and saying that the system is so fundamentally unfair, it must be overhauled. Here's the problem. What's the other system you want to put in place? This is the Western system that provides the most freedom on earth. That, as flawed as it may be, and it is awfully flawed, it is incredibly flawed. It allows for the most free will of people, and freedom is the thing that we prize the most. When we start mandating a more equal outcome, it necessarily reduces freedom because we are putting constraints on what people think and do. It is a reduction in free will. And this I covered in episodes 144 and 145 about equal outcome. Though I discussed in episode 145 about what can we do to equalize things if equal outcome isn't possible, if we can't make things fully equal, end all disparities between groups. My answer was a larger social safety net, which is part of it. In the machine that is free will and choices, if we go in more equal, meaning equal opportunity, we'll come out with more equal outcomes. Yes, there will be a ton of unfairness, and there will be racism, sexism, homophobia, nepotism, people helping other people who are, you know, an old boys club, not just of boys, but of guys who know each other from wherever. It'll always be a little bit unfair. But what we should strive for as a country is a reduction in that unfairness. And how do we know what's too fair, or rather too unfair, versus a proper amount of fairness? Because fairness is completely arbitrary and abstract in this sense, in this context. Fair isn't really abstract, but it's in this sense, I think it is. I don't know. That's the hard part about having a podcast, is that I feel like I'm supposed to have the answers, but I don't. What I can tell you, per episode 145, is that it scares me when we divide ourselves into groups like this, and decide that we want to make large-scale conclusions about how we want to change things without having a full picture of what that would look like. But that doesn't mean it's not wrong. It doesn't mean that we don't have problems. What I'm saying here, I think, is that the problem has been identified correctly. The solution is vague at best. It would be nice for reparations for Black people. Would that be the answer? That's a longer conversation, probably a separate podcast, a separate episode. How do we equalize things? How do we end this poverty? How do we, in this particular case, there's nothing we can do in the short term. The reality of people living close together in poverty in places like DC, Chicago, New Orleans, these things are going to be here for a while. How do we fix that? I don't know. How do we adjust the amount of empathy in people? That's probably the point of this episode in general. Because I started with talking about how groups stick together, how groups have a group lens through which they see things. And there are groups, the social justice groups, that do see the poverty and pain from those groups that are marginalized and want to correct it. They do have a lens there. They can identify the problem. I don't know if they've identified the solution because it's complicated. This is a giant system that's not just about money, it's also about culture. It's about history. It's about moving some nodes and expecting other nodes to stay where they are, but that's not how nodes work. It's complicated. So, in the end, what I'm saying is that it is true that to be Black and poor is the hardest place to be in this country, or per Charles Blow's column, the most vulnerable people. And it does make sense that people organize into groups to fight for their rights, to fight for equality, to fight for equal treatment under the law. It's similar to unions. Individuals have little power, but when you organize into groups, those groups have more sway. They make a bigger impact. And yes, bigger impacts need to be made. Changes need to be made. It's really simple from some perspectives to fix this. I don't think it's as easy as we think. Nobody can give anybody anything. Yes, we do need better education. That's probably step one. We do need people out of poverty so that they can have the mental and emotional bandwidth to take more advantage. And this was particularly hard hit by the 80s with the management consulting firms that eliminated middle management, which resulted in tons of layoffs, with the loss of the manufacturing sector, which eliminated tons of blue-collar jobs. We lost tons of jobs for those who were lower on the education ladder. And it is certainly true that there's a high correlation between education and income. So the closer one is to poverty, even if they're not in poverty, even if they're working a blue-collar job on a line somewhere in Kentucky, manufacturing tablecloths or whatever it may be, they weren't in poverty, but they were working a blue-collar job and they were probably making a lower income per year than somebody with a white-collar job who had education. And then you take those jobs away and those same less educated people now are still less educated with no job. It's a giant mess. And if we can't solve this problem by giving away money, and maybe that's a longer debate. Dave Estman, you're not talking about reparations. I'm not. Not in this episode. But I will in a future episode. Because it needs to be discussed. How do we fix this? I don't know. This episode is probably more about the logic of people sticking together in ways to say, well, Charles Blow speaking for the group with which he belongs, as he should, saying, my people are hurting, pay attention. While at the same time, white people look at, or rather, because here's the hard part, if 20.1% of black people are in poverty, that means 79.9% are not. The people who aren't in poverty, it's not just white people. Well, I mean, that's a longer conversation. How much do black people not in poverty care about black people in poverty? A fair amount, because we do stick to our groups. It is a group. Group identity is important. It's when we don't stand up for our group, it leaves our group capable of being marginalized as individuals. But those who are in the top quartile or perhaps the top half look at the situation from their own lens, and their own lens is probably, particularly in a crisis, let me take care of myself. This isn't my time to worry about others. I'm not saying that's a universality. I'm saying that there are, on a scale of 1 to 100, and in a normal non-crisis time, people cared about people in pain at level 70, where 100 is the most care that they could give. I'm saying that number's below 70. I'm saying it's more like 25 to 35. Because it's a crisis. And people are scared. And people retreat to their corners and think about things from their own point of view. In the same way that poverty puts stress on an individual. Well, poverty reduces a person's intellectual bandwidth. But things they can worry about because there are other things on their mind. In that same way, a crisis like this would reduce someone else's empathy and bandwidth for worrying about things other than themselves. So that is the end of this rambling podcast of How to Human. If you hated this podcast, the whole podcast, all 146 episodes, give it 5 stars. If you liked this podcast, the whole 146 episodes, give it 5 stars. You have to listen to all of them. Go back and listen. It's a back catalog. You'll love it. If you have comments or death threats, please send those to howtohumancdt@gmail.com. And I will talk to you next time on How to Human.